Welcome to Activation Energy by the Chemical Angel Network. I'm your host, Selma Duhovic. In this episode, Halima and I speak with Jeff Rosedale of Baker Hostetler about intellectual property for deep tech startups. Hi, Jeff. Welcome. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Selma. It's great to be here.
Let's start with Jeff. Please, can you walk us down your career path?
Okay. So, wow. Well, you know, I'm later in my career now, but I've been having a great time all along the way. I started out, you know, as a tech guy. Always loved technology. Was a big fan of science fiction. You know, I was in middle school when Star Wars came out, the original one. Okay, and always a good student. Went on to college. I didn't know what an engineer was. My family is not engineers, but my best friend Mike and his dad, IBM engineer, and so that's why I learned about engineering initially. And then had a great chemistry teacher, and I ended up going into chemical engineering in college. And then while I was there, I got a job at Bell Labs, you know, the famous Bell Laboratories. And I had my bachelor's in chemical engineering, working in the polymers and materials and chemical engineering group. And, I said, this is cool, but I guess I needed an advanced degree. So at the time, it was the late 80s. People were leaving Bell Labs, going to academia, at least the top scientists. And I basically figured, okay, I should go for that PhD in chemical engineering. I ended up following the PI that I worked with at Bell Labs to go to Minnesota. He became the full professor and I became his grad student. And that was great. I had published by then, by the time I'm a first year grad student, already published, already given talks as, you know, Bell Labs for 3 years. And then I got out of grad school just under 4 years because of the prior experience. We're at the University of Minnesota, which had a really good polymer program. And from there, I got a job in industry. I mean, I had an option to go into academia, but at that point, I wasn't interested in writing. It was funny. I wasn't interested in doing all that writing and grant writing. I was more interested in doing the work because I was really, you know, keen into technology. And we actually had filed 4 patents by then in the stuff that we were working on in grad school. Anyway, I ended up at a job which is now Dow Chemical, industrial research company was called Roman Haas back then, here in Philadelphia, which is where I am now. And from there, worked in R&D in advanced materials, making all different kinds of things, developing new materials for, back then it was, the laptop computers weren't color yet, or they're just starting to be color in the late 90s. And some of us remember that, some of us don't. But I was developing pigmented photoresist and other materials for making the flat panel displays. Anyway, long story short, I ended up transitioning into the patent group at what is now Dow Chemical, went to law school at night at Temple. And before then, I did some business school, half of a business degree at Wharton, a certificate program, because I was really interested in combining technology and business. And, you know, I was really into the whole, you know, again, going back to my love of science fiction, let's make the future, you know, and that's what always has been motivating me. Anyway, so I ended up graduating from law school, doing that at night, working full-time at what is now Dow Chemical, writing patents in the patent group, ended up moving into a law firm back in 2002. And I've been in that same law firm ever since then. There was a merger, but anyway, and I've been working with primarily a lot of universities, early stage technologies, companies. That's what floats my boat. I just love the tech. And most of my clients today are startups and, you know, professors, university people with advanced degrees developing the deep technology. And I've been doing that ever since.
Sounds like an enviably storied career. Thank you for sharing that. To start the discussion, I'd like to cover high-level trends. So in the dialogue between scientific advancements and legal frameworks, what topics are being addressed at the moment? Here, I'm thinking things like AI, big data, open source initiatives, and so on.
Yeah, AI is huge right now. AI is absolutely huge right now. There are issues on whether an AI can be an inventor. Who is an inventor? Okay. Initially, the patent office said, no, you can't, and that you can't name an AI as an inventor. And that actually goes all the way back to the Constitution and how the patent laws were written. The U.S. Constitution provides that inventors, people, shall be able to protect their inventions, you know, and so that's written right in there. So it all goes back to that. So there are many issues around AI. There is whether an AI can be an inventor. Right now, we say no, and you need a person. But an AI, to me, right now, is a tool. We don't see a sentient general intelligence yet. Okay, we don't see that yet. So right now, AI is tools. Okay, but there's a lot in terms of patenting inventions about AI. Large language models. I've worked with some researchers on that. We filed a large language model patent application. That's not only what I do. I tend to do a lot of different kinds of things, but AI is huge in terms of business right now, and also in terms of lawyer ethics. And that is a hot button issue right now. Actually, I'm part of a core group trying out new tools. I mean, right now, I was an early adopter of ChatGPT, not because of my own knowledge, but actually one of my kids. They knew about it and were telling me all about OpenAI. And as soon as, you could get a subscription on ChatGPT, I was curious and wanted to figure out what that's about. But lawyers have to be super careful. There are many cases where lawyers are being basically getting into trouble because ChatGPT it makes up a lot of stuff. And a couple of things that you have to know is lawyers can't be putting confidential information into ChatGPT the way it is right now, because that's an open, it could use, if I put confidential information about one of the inventions that I'm working on, say, please write a patent about this, and here are the key aspects, I'm committing basically an ethical violation, and I could get into serious trouble for doing that. And so there's a lot of issues regarding, can lawyers use it, especially the open stuff? The answer is no, you can't put confidential information, but there's a lot of vendors out there, and we're working with the vendors who are trying to create the private confidential model. So it doesn't go out to the general system, but we have access to a limited, if you will, system where it's private and maintains, both confidentiality and attorney-client privilege, which is what we try to maintain. So AI by far is the number one tech thing that's taking up a lot of our times, both professionally as well as from a business and new companies, and what can they do with it.
You touched upon it, but I'm wondering if you could elaborate a bit more on the approaches that law firms like Baker Hostetler are taking to address challenges posed by rapidly evolving technologies like AI?
Well, we as a firm, I mean, there are 1,000 lawyers in my law firm that I currently work for. And we as a firm are very pro-technology oriented. We have a whole group just dedicated to technology and how lawyers can best utilize the technology. And there's certainly a lot of vendors out there who try to sell lawyers and law firms these services. Okay, so, we always think about, well, search services and various services that are sold to law firms. But there's a lot now. We're seeing a lot in the AI arena as well. So we actually have a core group, and we stay on top of it and we learn about it. Lawyers, at least in almost every state in the country, are required to take 12 hours or so of continuing legal education credits. Okay. And I actually had a credit recently just on this, on the topic of AI ethics. What is ethical for a lawyer to do, and what can a lawyer do and can't do when it comes to, using artificial intelligence, large language models, things like ChatGPT. So we, to a certain amount, as a profession, there are a lot of resources to ensure that we stay on top of what's going on. Because once lawyers start misusing it or not realizing that you can't just have ChatGPT create a legal brief for you with all the citations and submit it to the court, if you're in a litigation, and even though it sounds right and looks right and smells right, when you look at the details, a lot of it is made up. A lot of people know about this and have heard about the lawyers getting in trouble for doing this.
What are the most important trends or emerging issues in patent law that entrepreneurs and innovators should be aware of?
That's a huge question. The trends in patent law, there's always the trend right now. Every time there's a patent case before the U.S. Supreme Court, we basically, we hold our breath, to see, okay, how is the court going to change, what we know. 20 plus years ago, it used to be okay for businesses to get their business methods and systems patented, which corresponded with the early internet and, doing business online. Nowadays, there's, the court came in, basically, you can't do that anymore. So what is patentable, what you could get a patent on, is currently still a big issue. There are questions as to what is too abstract, what is considered a law of nature. An area that I do a lot of work with is in medical diagnostics. And because of the way that the court has been handling lately, at least in the last 10 years, is that it's really, really tough to basically get a new test for breast cancer, right? I mean, that's really hard. And so there are ways to kind of get around it. You say, well, you test for breast cancer, and if there's a positive, then you treat. So you turn the what is called a diagnostic into a method of treatment. I think that's wrong. I think the court went too far to say that, basically saying, you know, if you're testing, you're doing a medical diagnostic for finding out whether somebody has a disease or not, that's really important. And that should be patentable, because I think that's something that's, so what is patentable? That's a big issue right now. And we're seeing also some recent cases as to, you know, what is the standard for patentability? And so in order to have something patentable, obviously you have to have a new invention, which means that it's never been seen before. You could always patent improvements, right? And then the question is, but you can't patent an obvious improvement. And it's always a time-worn tradition question, argument as to what is considered obvious and what's not obvious, okay? And what is a standard that is used? So that's also going to potentially be, it's always an issue, and it's always good to see how the court will determine that right now.
Let's shift gears and talk about the integration of IP and business. I'm wondering, when working with the deep tech startups, what key pieces of advice do you find yourself giving most frequently to entrepreneurs about how they should think about integrating IP with business development?
Right. The number one thing that startups, you know, don't have is usually a lot of cash. Okay. Unfortunately, IP requires a lot of cash. You know, it's an expensive proposition. So when I'm working with startups, you know, usually it's, okay, we need one good patent application file, okay? And that's what, and the question is, well, what do you need your IP for? Is it because, you know, you're a startup, but you could imagine you're going to be, you know, manufacturing and you just want to have worldwide domination? No, usually startups need to get the investment. They need to get to the next step. So your initial patents have to do what? They have to satisfy the needs of your next investors who are going to be doing the due diligence on you to make sure that you have good technology, that you have ownership rights. That's an issue, is make sure that you own it and not somebody else owns it. And to make sure that what you are filing your patent on protects the most important aspects. Why will people buy it? Why will a competitor try to steal it? And that's what you should focus your initial patent on. And I usually say patent, you know, let's start with one, that, you know, one good patent, which protects it. What is it? What is it that people will be lining up at your door for, to either to buy from you or to steal from you? And that's what you should focus your patent on, your patent application. So that's usually where I start, is let's focus on that. Now, that's usually when you have more of a, what I say, a tech entrepreneur versus, let's say, life sciences. Life sciences is very different. Half of what I do is life sciences, half of what I do is non-life sciences, tech, advanced materials, AI, you know, virtual reality, et cetera. But when it comes to life sciences, they, you know, usually if we're dealing with perhaps, you know, as a startup, a licensee from a university, okay? And the license has to do with, let's say there's a cancer molecule. I have a couple of different clients. They've licensed a cancer, a molecule chemistry, and a class of molecules for combating, for treating or preventing a certain kind of cancer. Startup company wants to come in and license that technology. And that requires, that's the molecule. We need an important worldwide patent on that molecule. Why? Because that's, we're thinking about the end game, is that we're thinking about what's going to happen is, we as a small startup out of university trying to develop a cancer drug, we're not going to be the ones who are going to be doing all the phase 1, 2, 3 trials and getting FDA regulatory approval. That costs $1 billion, okay? What we're trying to get it to the next level, to maybe up to phase 1, get in the investment, and then eventually, if it looks good, it'll be bought by Big Pharma. Okay, but Big Pharma, what do they want? They want to see a fairly broad worldwide patent strategy. So early on, we're thinking, a lot of countries, and that's a lot more expensive than, say, when we're dealing with just a tech company a tech company may be US only, or maybe US, Europe, Japan, China, versus a lot more countries, which is a very expensive proposition.
So considering resource constraints and potential legal complexities, how can startups in deep tech effectively and efficiently maneuver through the intricacies of the IP landscape?
That is a really, really important question. They need to be mindful. They need to educate themselves on intellectual property. Almost every startup I've worked for, I think, yeah, every startup I work for, obviously, needs to have some kind of IP protection. I mean, sometimes people come, I talk to them, and for whatever reason, they're not ready, they don't have the money, or it's not appropriate. I'll tell them quickly, it's not appropriate. If you're looking at we're going to make maybe a couple $100,000 with this product, I'm saying, no, you don't want to be spending IP money. Only when, you know, your $10 million, $100 million or more business potential, that upside, because, you know, IP, you're initially starting at a $10,000 spend. And usually it goes up from there for usually most things these days. So it's important to make sure that it makes sense to be thinking about. And again, we're talking mainly about patents. Obviously, there's trademarks, there's copyright issues, trade secrets, but we're focusing mainly on patents right now. And in that regard, you should probably be thinking about, again, going back to what I said earlier, is this a tech company? Is it a life sciences company? What is your plan of attack? How are you, do you plan to build the company? What is the current funding level and where are you going? And it has a lot to do on, you know, scale. Again, if it's going to be life sciences, you're trying to cure cancer, you better have a lot of investment early on. You can't be starting out like two students with $10,000 between them. That's not going to cut it. You need to bring in basically venture or angel groups. There's a lot of angel groups out there, and then and seed funding. A lot of universities these days will have those kinds of connections. A lot of alumni have groups that are interested in investing in early stage seed funds for current students at the universities. So that's something to be looking at as well.
Let's shift gears again and talk about valuation. How do you go about valuing intellectual property?
Every startup tech company needs some kind of IP protection. From a valuation, it's like you have to have it. And initially, I've worked with startups and where they have to put down what is the paper value of the company right now. Once you file a patent application, you got something that seems reasonably good, and automatically your valuation goes to $1 million with IP. So you go from like almost nothing, $10,000, to, oh, you filed a patent application. Even if it's just a provisional, a full patent application, okay? I see the kinds of numbers, it's you could get $1 million valuation. So it's one of the reasons why I don't write these patents for free initially, is because they're worth $1 million, even though it may be only a $10,000 or a $20,000 bill, when it's all said and done. So that's just something. Now, as far as, again, life sciences, it's everything, okay? You have to have a worldwide patent portfolio covering the therapeutic drug methodology, preferably the drug, the compound, ideally. Sometimes it's a formulation of a compound. And then preferably you're going to have multiple. So, you know, early biotechs, you need a $10, $20, $30 million, $40 million valuation, okay, as you develop your biotech into hundreds of millions of dollars before it then would get picked up by basically purchased by a large pharma or another biotech technology company. And that's mostly almost all IP and the regulatory work that goes into that and all the data. So it's all worth that. And early on in my career, wasn't my client, but it was a firm client. And the founder was at, I think it was a bio meeting back in 2008 in Philadelphia. And the CEO was asked that very question, is like, well, how much did you spend on your IP? And it was about, he said, yeah, about 30% of what we raised, 30% was directed towards IP. Okay, as mostly to pay for all the worldwide patents. That's pretty high. You think about that. I mean, if they raised $100 million, I don't think it was 100, but if it was $50 million, $15 million for IP over the course of 5 or 10 years before he finally was able to sell his company. That's on the high end. But as far as valuations go, it's really important that that companies know what they're doing. I had a company that can't tell you the details other than they were in the middle of a due diligence to sell the company. And I was brought in to help to do a valuation on the IP by the board of directors. And when all was said and done, we were actually able to get a 30 or 35% higher valuation because nobody had figured out that the IP was actually really valuable. It actually told the buyer that we own the space. And if you want to have leverage over the competition, not only are you buying the employees and the manufacturing and sales and everything else that's going on for that technology, it was in an electronic space, but you're also buying all this IP, which gives you the leverage to assert if necessary, if you wanted to get some more control over some of the competing products that were out there that were presumably infringing.
So you kind of touched base on this, but can you share a success story where the strategic management and valuation of IP significantly impacted a deep tech startup's growth?
In a medical diagnostic space, early on in my career, actually one of my very first clients, it was a university spin out involving DNA analysis and handling. And, you know, we were there early on with the initial, we actually wrote the patent for the university, worked directly with the founding scientists and got permission from the university to work with the spin out. And from there, we helped them early on with doing a lot of, if you know, the sitting around brainstorming about what can we use this technology for and thinking about all the different ways of thinking about what it can be used for, what are the applications, and then basically crafting a set of claims. This is what we want. The patents are all based upon the claims. The legal right that you get is based upon the patent claim. And as a result, by doing basically sitting down, doing a strategic analysis, and then putting that all together, we wrote a series of patents early on, and that company, it really helped the company to manage and to attract the investment that they needed to then. You know, they're now a publicly held company. They did IPO, and you know, can't tell you any much more about that. But it required early strategic thinking and being mindful of the costs involved. You know, they weren't a therapeutic, which required, you know, very wide filing, but you know, they were more of a medical technology, and so we were very critical. You know, we wanted to analyze, well, yeah, U.S., Europe, China, Japan, some of the basic tech companies, which is where you do patenting these days.
I'd like to discuss the idea of collaboration. So deep tech often involves collaborating and partnering with universities, customers, and complementers. How do you navigate the complexities of protecting intellectual property when multiple entities are involved in the development of a technology?
Sure. Well, that's that requires really good communication. That requires working with each university. Well, you know, where there's research, each research university, major research university, will have a technology transfer office, and these are people who are usually not patent lawyers, but people who have been working with patents. They work with licensing. They know how to do deals, and they will have advanced degrees, and they have responsibility for a certain part of the university. Like you'll have a PhD chemist working in the technology transfer office of a particular university, and they'll be in charge of the chemistry department and, you know, other chemical inventions that are made. And, you know, I'm working with one right now, several actually right now. And, you know, while we would represent not the university, we would represent the startup. So if the professor wanted to spin the technology out of the university, I would work with them, and the university would not be our client necessarily, most likely not. Sometimes they are. And we need to balance all the different voices and all the different, the flow of the information. Because what do universities want? They want research. What do the professors want? They want to be able to publish, right? They want to become famous if they're not already famous, okay? Everybody likes money. Okay, universities like money, the professors like money, okay? And so we have to balance all those interests. And so when it comes to the sharing of information, you have to manage that through non-disclosure agreements, or sometimes the transfer materials. If there's a special material was made as being licensed out, there's a material transfer agreement. Sometimes there are multiple universities involved. It happens all the time. You'll have somebody, you know, you'll have a Professor A from one university working with Professor B from another university because Professor A made the molecules, but gave it to Professor B, who's doing the testing of the molecules. But now we have a joint invention. How do you deal with all that? And there's something called an inter-institutional agreement. And so, yeah, this is something that, you know, I, through my experience working, you know, with these kinds of organizations for the last 20 plus years, and it's a language, it's a lingo, it is a cast of characters. And yeah, you just got to, you know, make sure that you're asking the right questions, you spot the right issues, because who is an inventor on a patent is very important to who owns the patent. And that gets, that's oftentimes some of the issues. The other thing is if the research is published before you file a patent, you basically potentially have destroyed your ability to get a patent in most countries of the world. There are a couple of exceptions. The United States is an exception, but usually because the university professors, they want to publish, or the students or the postdocs especially, they're trying to get the next job lined up. They want as many publications on their CV as possible. Okay. So you have to manage that. And sometimes you have to say, no, you can't publish it yet. We have to file the patent. And that's hard, but right people, if you're dealing with the right people, they'll understand.
Let's talk about the logistics of licensing. So obviously pretty much all deep tech ventures have licensed IP from universities or in some cases, large corporations. Deep tech does not come from a garage. Can you describe how that process works? How should entrepreneurs navigate it so that they balance the interests of both parties and there is a win-win situation after the negotiation?
Well, it's really hard early on. If you have a startup and a startup has very little money, then it's going to be the very first thing that they'd be looking at would potentially be getting first of all, you have to get the PI on board, right? The professor, whoever the professor is, that professor has a lot of control and sway, especially if they are what I would like to say a big professor that brings in a lot of money into the university. If that professor is on board, that professor likes the idea, or maybe the professor wants to be part of the founding team, or maybe it's the postdoc or the grad student. That's usually the professor doesn't want to give up their day job and, you know, be a CEO, which can be a real difficult job, but would be willing, yes, I'll be a founder, I'll be, you know, chief science officer, but you grad student postdoc, you run the company, you do all the work, you figure out how to do everything, and I'll sitting on some of the meetings and review. So that's like first is get professor buy-in. And then the question is, you then talk to the tech transfer office, you know, and you have no money, then you have to tell the tech transfer office, look, we have no money. What can you do for us? And usually they'll say, here's some resources. Here's an alumni venture fund. Here's an alumni angel fund. You know, maybe we'll have a handshake agreement for the next 6 months because it's big professor guy or, you know, person. But that's how things usually get started. Sometimes there, you know, the professor already has a track record or has a source of funding, and they want to be an investor in the company and puts that into the coffers of the company, and we'll do the initial licensing. But then the professor has two hats, and that could be potentially a conflict. And I tell my professors who do that, I said, which hat are you wearing right now? Are you wearing professor hat or are you wearing entrepreneur hat? Because you have, and also be very careful, because if you're making further inventions from the company, then you need to have permission from the university to basically be working as an independent consultant, that one day every week or 2 weeks, whatever your contract with the university says that you're allowed to do. And also be mindful of making sure that getting the permission is usually getting a written letter from the vice president or the dean of research or somebody like that. This way, when you're doing that direct work and there are more inventions made, that it's the company invention, not the university invention. So yeah, there's a lot to manage and juggle there.
And what factors are considered when determining the licensing fees, both cash and equity, for a particular IP asset? What do licensors care about, and what do they consider when deciding whether or not to license their IP?
That's a fantastic question, because what's also built into a license agreement on basically life science technology, curing cancer, you'll see a lot in terms of milestone payments that the university wants. In connection with, well, are you in phase one, phase two, phase three? Did you license it? Do you sublicense it? And so universities see a lot of big dollar signs, okay, when there's a license to be done with a startup, because the startup knows that, again, most likely they're not going to build a company that makes and sells and markets the drug worldwide. They're going to get bought out. Okay, so the university definitely is looking at potential equity or participation rights in equity if there's an IPO. And also they want to see all the big payouts. And, you know, phase three, we want $10 million. If you make it to phase three, then that's one of the things that we get. Or if you sublicense, you know, obviously, we're going to be getting maybe 25% of the revenue that we would normally get. Anyway, but yeah, it's very, very different. Whereas if you're in a water tech, a clean tech, an electronics, an optics, a virtual reality, you know, anything other than that, it's a different model in which in the way that the innovation is commercialized and monetized. Okay. And then they're just looking at, okay, we'll get 5% on royalties, whatever, that kind of thing.
Thank you for making a distinction between life science IP and that of deep tech.
Sure. Oh, yeah, it's a great question. It's a big difference, big difference. And yeah, and the life science, obviously licensing, a lot more complicated.
What are the common pitfalls that entrepreneurs may encounter during this IP licensing process? How can they be avoided? And what strategies can be implemented to prevent conflicts from arising in the first place?
Okay. Well, usually, I mean, once you get into the license agreement, you know, the only conflict is running out of money and being on the hook to pay for the IP. And again, that's running out of money. That's the number one thing. And I've had clients would have to renegotiate an amendment to the license agreement. You know, if they thought that they were going to do really well, and oftentimes a university will like to have an annual licensing fee. Okay. So you have to pay, you know, $25,000 a year, every year. Sometimes it's more, or it's an increasing, you know, this year for year one, you pay 25,000, year two, you pay 30, you know, it goes up and up and up. But if after a few years, the company runs out of money, then they have to think about if they still want to stay in business, they do not want to lose the license, because if you lose the license, you lose the patents, and then you have nothing. Okay. And so how do you avoid that? Great communication. Stay in contact with the university. Make sure your professor is in you know, good standing with the university. It doesn't happen all the time. And if changes need to be made, then changes need to be made. I mean, that's what happens. So that's how you avoid the conflicts. It's usually the good communication and communicate early. And if you're having a funding issue, that also asks some broader questions. Well, you know, do we have the right team trying to commercialize this technology? And that's what one of the things that the universities want to do. Is they want the licensee, okay, the entrepreneur to be the right people or group of people, okay? And if they can't commercialize it, then university, if they think it's still valuable IP, but it's the wrong team, then they want to pull back. They'll say no, and that's the end of the license. Now, luckily, I haven't had that. Luckily, I haven't.
Last question. What are the two most important pieces of advice that you always give to entrepreneurs?
Well, sure. You know, number one is don't forget about the IP. It is so easy to stay in a lab where it's fun and develop and make and tinker. I mean, I was that kind of a person. I love to work in a lab, develop, tinker, make stuff, try stuff out. And, you know, before you know it, it's 6 p.m. and you're expected home for dinner, you know, and you've been out and then there's like almost no time for IP. It's really important to schedule oneself, make it part of your business hygiene. Okay. You're going to network a certain amount. You're going to develop a certain amount. You're going to maintain your relationships. You're going to raise money. You're going to talk to investors, and you're also going to think about your IP and talk to your lawyer, whoever it is, and don't be afraid of calling your lawyer so that you're not afraid to call your lawyer. Work out an annual agreement. Say, I could call you many times, you know, 5 minute, 10 minute phone calls, and you're not going to charge me for all of them if I give you a little bit of money up front. I mean, those are some of the silly things I see. I see when clients are very hesitant to want to call me, and they should have called me. And I said, you should have called me. You know, we could have avoided this. You know, it would have taken 10 minutes. And anyway, that's, it's juggling. There are so many parts to starting a venture. I mean, obviously having something great, something that the world will beat a path for to your door for. Obviously, you want that, and that will take a lot of work. And it's not just having a great idea. It's usually a great idea and a lot of work. Okay, the hard problems are the ones that need to be solved, and the ones that will usually, you know, be the best ventures. At least what I've seen. The easy stuff, if it's easy, obviously was done already, or in the end, it's really not all that valuable. It's the hard stuff. That's why the deep tech, lots of research, lots of thinking, solving the problems, and then doing everything else that you need to help to develop and bring it to the world. I think about, you know, Doc Brown, right, from Back to the Future, right, working in his lab back in the 1950s. And anyway, you get the idea. you get the idea. So
great. Thanks so much again for sharing your insight with us, Jeff.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. It's nice to talk to you both, Selma and Halima.